This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Fresh from their historic victory in passing health care reform, congressional Democrats passed another sweeping proposal yesterday, but not quite as sweeping. This one will transform the federal government's 45-year-old student loan program. The plan, put forward by the Obama administration, ends the government's current partnership with private lenders. It makes the U.S. Education Department solely responsible for issuing government-backed loans. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, that makes some colleges and students nervous.
Now that Congress has passed the Obama administration's direct lending proposal, banks and private lenders won't be allowed to issue federal student loans. Instead, beginning July 1, these loans will come directly from the U.S. Department of Education.
We'll see how that goes.
Melissa Gregory is director of financial aid at Montgomery College in suburban Maryland. Over 22,000 students at this two-year college rely on government-backed loans. Gregory, though, isn't sure the education department can handle the jump in student loan applications with private lenders now out of the picture.
Can they handle the service component? Calls from students, explaining things to students, that will be a real challenge for the Department of Education. And it's one they say they're ready to handle.
It's not that the department hasn't done it before. The direct lending program has been in place since 1993 and already accounts for almost half of all federal student loans. But that number will more than double in the next 3 months. 20-year-old Marianne Mullen has her own concerns. She's graduating from Montgomery College in May and will have to borrow $25,000 to attend a private four-year college in Ohio in the fall. She worries about having only one lender to choose from now, the U.S. Department of Education.
Getting completely rid of the private sector, I'm not sure would be the best idea. I think that direct lending has great reviews right now, but what is that going to look like in 10 years would be one of my concerns.
None of Nova Scotia.
Some of the theater majors at this rehearsal of A Midsummer Night's Dream are a little nervous about the switch to direct lending, too. But not 22-year-old Richard Dancy. He says he hates dealing with banks.
Because of my immediate need for funds, I had to go and get the money from a private lender. And the interest rate is double on the private loan, 12.5%, 13%.
Direct lending, says Dancy, can't possibly be more stressful or complicated than what's been in place until now.
You kind of take all the middlemen out, and so the money that's being made off loans is funneled right back into the government rather than going to these banks.
The government is paying private lenders over $8 billion a year in subsidies right now. Once the shift to direct lending is complete, most of that money will go towards a $425 increase in the Pell Grant for the neediest students. Nothing wrong with that, says Senator Lamar Alexander. He's a former U.S. Secretary of Education and one of the Republican leaders in Congress who opposed direct lending. If the Obama administration really wants to give students a break, though, Alexander says, why not use those savings to cut the interest rate on student loans? Otherwise, says Alexander,
this is going to cost the students about $1,700 to $1,800 in higher interest payments over 10 years on an average $25,000 loan. And I think when students get their loans and they start going back to school in the fall, they're not going to be very happy.
Proponents of direct lending say Alexander's figures and his argument are misleading. Interest rates are not going up. Under direct lending, students won't pay more than the fixed rate set by Congress, 6.8%. And so the switch to direct lending is a done deal. And not just because the Congress passed it. As Melissa Gregory observes, before private lenders and banks were pushed out, many had pulled out on their own.
I think we're to the point now that trying to do student loans through the banks is just too risky for us as a school. I need to go with something stable.
Montgomery College has already processed its first 80 direct student loans without a glitch. By July 1st, all 5,500 colleges in the federal student loan program will have to do the same, whether they want to or not. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
One big problem with owning an electric car for anyone who doesn't have a garage or a parking space with an outlet nearby is where to plug in. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren talked with an entrepreneur in Maryland who's building systems where city-dwelling electric car drivers can plug in.
California already has a bunch of public and private electric vehicle charging stations. Many of them are free. But if you live anywhere else, your options are very limited. With the Chevy Volt and Nissan Leaf due to hit the streets at the end of the year, a handful of small companies are trying to change that. Mahi Reddy's company, SemaConnect, already is starting to sell hookups. He wants to sell them to hotels, apartment complexes, office buildings, and other businesses for electric car drivers to use.
This could be installed on the street, which means as you park on the street, you can plug into this.
But to do so, you'd have to have something that looks like a credit card.
So we would give you a little smart card, and every time you wave it in front of one of these devices, it recognizes that, and that would be linked to your credit card account. And kind of like EasyPass, it would charge your credit card.
The technology does this by metering how much electricity you use and then connecting wirelessly to the web. Reddy's devices cost about $2,500 to install. Some higher voltage quick charging stations can cost 10 times that much. But Reddy says companies will be able to make up the investment by charging for the power. It's not clear yet what the going rate will be to charge up. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
The NCAA men's basketball tournament continues to provide thrilling finishes with the demise of top-seeded teams. NPR's Mike Pesca was at the games in Syracuse, New York, and he joins us now to talk about it. Good morning, Mike.
Hi.
Let's start with Syracuse University, which was not playing in Syracuse, but in Salt Lake City, and feeling rather far from home, losing to Butler. What went wrong?
Yes, so the rule is you can't play on your home court. So there, Syracuse was, as a number one seed, playing a team in Butler that the basketball cognoscenti knew were a good team, but still they have the number five next to their name, in other words, a five seed. So if they beat a number one seed, it would be an upset, and that is indeed what happened. Butler got out to a 10-point halftime lead, and in the second half, they saw it all evaporate. But rather than discuss specifics, here in general is what is going on in the tournament. The teams that are seeded 1 and 2, these are teams from the traditional power conferences, but there is such a diminishing difference between these power teams and these really good teams from leagues like Butler's Horizon or the Missouri Valley or the Atlantic 10, and Butler shows it's every bit as good as Syracuse. The key to this game was the fact that Syracuse had a lot of turnovers, 18, mostly because Butler stole the ball a lot. Butler, as the basketball guys will tell you, valued the ball more, and that was a key to a victory.
And then in the next game, it was a similar matchup, Xavier versus Kansas State. Was this another upset by a small school?
Well, yeah, Xavier is a small school, literally, in terms of enrollment. They have about 4,000 undergrads. Kansas State, over 20,000. Xavier has been good at basketball for a while, but it was a smaller conference versus a big conference. Kansas State plays in the Big 12. This was the best game of the tournament. This game went into double overtime, and every time it went into an extra session, you couldn't believe what was happening. In regulation, Kansas State was up by 3, and a Xavier player got fouled, and he hit 1, then 2, then 3 free throws. Imagine the pressure on this college kid, Terrell Holloway, as he calmly drains that. And again, in the first overtime, Xavier was down by 3, and one of their players, Jordan Crawford, who scored 32 points, he hit a shot from so far away, maybe 32 to 35 feet, sent it into the second overtime. But eventually, Kansas State showed that it is toughness, and they pulled out the victory.
Well, okay. Well, Mike, let's get quickly, while we have time, to the games you watched there in Syracuse, where you are, where West Virginia and Kentucky won. Of course, they were number one, number two seeds.
Right. So you'd assume that that would happen, except so far, number one seeds are losing and number two seeds are losing. So to analyze the first game that was played, West Virginia really outlasted the University of Washington. West Virginia feeds off the personality of its coach, Bobby Huggins. He's a tough guy, and they're a tough team, and they outmuscled a University of Washington team that was an 11 seed. And the last game was a game we were all very excited for because Kentucky, chock full of these future NBA players, was taking on an Ivy League school, Cornell. And up until now, Cornell had shown that they belong on the same court as really any great team in the country. They jumped out to a 10-2 lead, but then Kentucky said, hey, this is why we're going to play in the NBA. They went on a 30-6 run to end the half, and they really didn't look back. And so West Virginia and Kentucky, those two teams will face off to see who's in the Final Four.
Mike, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
NPR's Mike Pesca.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Today we're going to return to a story that we brought you 1 year ago, the story of a bank failure in Washington State, the Bank of Clark County. Since the start of this financial crisis, the government agency that insures our banks, the FDIC, has had to swoop in and take over hundreds of banks, including the Bank of Clark County. Most of its employees had no idea their bank was failing that day. Todd Zalk, a business banker, was standing in the lobby for a staff meeting.
And then all these people, and mostly in suits and professional clothing with attorney-type briefcases, started entering the bank, just flooding into the bank.
Well, now Hannah Jaffe Walt with our Planet Money team tells the story of what happens after failure.
I started with the FDIC guy in charge of all those men in suits, the one who ran the Bank of Clark County operation, Ron Hodges. And 1 year later, he was hard to track down. I finally got him on a bad cell phone connection. He said there was no landline we could use. So my first question, where are you?
Well, right now I'm at an undisclosed location getting ready for another bank closing that will take place in about an hour.
And that's what you're doing right now?
Yes.
How many failures have you worked since we talked?
Wow. Probably quite a few, 10 to 15.
Ron is hard to reach because he's been flying all over the country taking over banks. The FDIC has taken over 175 failed banks since the Bank of Clark County. And these are secret, sudden Friday events where the bank staff go from being regular bank workers to unemployed people with a failed bank on their resume. And they don't just lose their job. In some ways, they lose their identity. I didn't quite get this until I met Todd Zalk 1 month after the bank failed. Todd is a man whose identity was so wrapped up in the bank that 4 weeks after failure, he was still wearing his Bank of Clark County name tag, still introducing himself this way.
My name is Todd Zalk, Bank of Clark County, the best community business bank because we've changed the game in business banking.
I worried about Todd over the months and was relieved when I called him now, 1 year later, to hear he has found a new identity.
Well, Hannah, my name is Todd Zalk, and I am a business banking specialist with Wells Fargo Bank. Our product is our service. I like to tell my business clients that. And I've always been wired by service, Hannah. You know that about me.
I do know that about Todd, who, when speaking, makes sure to mention my name as often as possible. Todd is a true company man. He's moved on, got a new job, and more than half of his former colleagues have also found new work. But for Todd, it took a long time for him to really let go, to accept the failure. Because until very recently, the story in the community in Todd's mind was that the Bank of Clark County failed because of aggressive real estate loans, sure, but mostly it was just that the market changed so fast. The bank got dragged down with it. That was until one Sunday last month.
Oh, well, I was actually at church. And I had people approaching me, coming up to me saying, Todd, did you know that guy that was just indicted in the article yesterday about Bank of Clark County? And I said, no, what article? I just didn't see it. I'm asking them, well, who was it? And they didn't remember.
It was David Kennelly, the bank's chief loan officer. And the local paper reported that Kennelly had just pled guilty to hiding key documents from banking regulators. The plea agreement says Kennelly and other executives knew bank loans were going bad a year before the failure. And instead of reporting that information to regulators, Kennelly hid it. He made a fake spreadsheet showing only the healthy loans. When regulators came to inspect the bank, he directed staff to hide the unhealthy spreadsheet in a basket under someone's desk. Todd Zalk, ultimate bank loyalist, read this newspaper article slowly.
Yeah, Bank of Clark County, the best community business bank because they changed the game in business banking. What I didn't know is that they cheated and now they lost. The sense of pride that I had of working at Bank of Clark County is tarnished.
It's gone now.
I don't want to say it, Hannah, but you can. It is. I think it's gone now.
Soon after the failure, a nearby bank took over the deposits from the Bank of Clark County. But they left the bad stuff, the stuff that was hidden under the desk, for the FDIC to deal with. yet another pile of assets to try to resolve. The FDIC now has $563 billion in these failed bank assets. And it takes a long time to go through them. Ron Hodges, the FDIC guy with the bad cell phone connection, he was assigned to stay in Clark County after the failure. So he spent 5 months trying to collect on those loans, basically making calls to local businesses and developers repeating this message.
Look, you took out a loan with the intention of paying 100% of it, and now we expect you to do that.
Turns out when it's the federal government calling and not some tiny community bank, people respond. Ron and his team managed to collect some money from debtors this way. They also got some quick cash just selling the bank's chairs and plants and computers in an auction online. The real estate loans, though, this is what the FDIC is working overtime trying to sort out. They've got private investors trying to help them, but there's no way they'll get it all back. The FDIC takes the loss. Ron Hodges and I talked for a while. And then right before he had to go do his takeover, I had what I thought was just one quick last question. How did you feel leaving the Bank of Clark County?
It was hard.
There was silence for a long while after this. And finally, Ron says, I worked with those people for 5 months. I was in one place working side by side to wind down their bank.
They become more allies as opposed to adversaries. And you become friends with them. And when I left, this particular group gave me a cake, wrote me a nice card. Typically, you don't get that. Typically, it's good riddance, goodbye, I'm glad you're gone. And when they all came down, the entire bank presented me with this cake and card and told me how sad they are to see me leave. And it was a very emotional event for me.
Ron is tired. He travels all the time, works 14-hour days, most of the time providing an invisible service, keeping our banking system stable. Right after we hung up, he took over the Century Security Bank in Duluth, Georgia. On the same day, the FDIC was also in Utah, Alabama, Ohio, and Minnesota, taking over a total of 7 failed banks. Hanna Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
And some Americans, as we've heard, still have hard feelings about a law they never wanted. Now, one rare example of bipartisanship may be another casualty of the bitter debate. Cooperation between Republicans and Democrats who have long worked together to oppose abortion. NPR's Julie Rovner reports on the escalating war of words.
For Democrats and Republicans who oppose abortion, party has long been secondary. That is until Sunday, when Democratic abortion opponents broke with Republican abortion opponents to help pass the health bill. That led to this conclusion from Eric Erickson, a Republican consultant and head of RedState.com, an influential conservative blog.
Like unicorns and Perseus, pro-life Democrats are myths.
He'd get an argument on that point from Bart Stupak of Michigan. Stupak very nearly prevented the bill from passing over the abortion language. He only voted for it in the end after he extracted a promise from President Obama for an executive order. In that order, signed Wednesday, the president promised not to use the new law to expand abortion rights. That gave Stupak and his anti-abortion Democratic colleagues the assurance they needed to vote for the measure.
With the final bill plus the executive order, make no doubt about it, there will be no public funds for abortion.
But New Jersey Republican Chris Smith, who co-chairs the Congressional Pro-Life Caucus with Stupak, saw things quite a bit differently.
We are looking at legislation that contains within it the largest expansion of publicly funded abortion in history.
Not surprisingly, Republicans and Democrats who oppose abortion also disagreed on the impact of the health bill. Ohio Democrat Marcy Kaptur said that giving more people health insurance could actually make it more likely that women with unintended pregnancies will carry those pregnancies to term.
In those communities that have provided maternal care and health care for children, for all children, we find that the abortion rate goes down significantly.
But Republican Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota predicted the opposite.
If there is taxpayer funding of abortion, there will be 30% more abortions.
It got downright nasty later in the evening on the House floor. Republicans tried to offer anti-abortion language as an amendment to the so-called health care fix-it bill. Democrat Bart Stupak got up to oppose it.
The motion to recommit does not promote life. It is the Democrats who have stood up. It is the Democrats who have stood up to suspend. Those who were shouting out are out of order.
During the outburst, Texas Republican Randy Neugebauer shouted out, "Baby killer." Democrats booed. Political scientist John Green says he was stunned by the divide he saw develop on Sunday.
I was sitting there with my jaw dropping, you know, watching, you know, this debate unfold between people who had been pretty strong allies for quite some time.
Green heads the Bliss Institute of Applied Politics at the University of Akron. He's studied the politics of abortion for years. But Green says in some ways you can't be too surprised, given the overall partisan tone that's taken hold in Washington.
Particularly for elected officials, partisanship may ultimately count more than issues when push comes to shove.
But Green says there was a religious split that made the political split possible. While Catholic bishops continued to oppose the health bill on anti-abortion grounds, Catholic nuns and hospitals said it did, in fact, prohibit abortion funding.
And I think that made a big difference because it gave many pro-life Democrats some cover to compromise on the bill.
In the end, Green says, the debate boiled down to a simple matter of trust. Democrats believe that President Obama will keep his word to prevent abortion funding. Republicans don't. Here's Republican Joe Pitts of Pennsylvania.
This puts the fate of the unborn in the hands of the most pro-abortion president in history.
And there are indications that the fight could get beyond just words. Over the past 36 hours, there have been increasing reports of threats made against lawmakers in the wake of the health bill votes. Many of those threats have been directed against Stupak and his group of anti-abortion Democrats who voted for the health care bill. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
For answers to some of your questions about the health care overhaul law, visit our website, NPR.org. The holiest week on the Christian calendar is nearly upon us. Next week, believers reflect on the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. This year, there's something of a dust-up among evangelicals over core beliefs about who Jesus was and whether he is the only way to salvation. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
Recently, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville convened a school-wide event to talk about a new book by a popular evangelical Christian. It wasn't pretty. Southern Baptist theologian Jim Hamilton summed up the book this way.
It is a new kind of Christianity that is no Christianity at all.
Then theologian Bruce Ware chipped in.
You know, I've thought of Brian McLaren for years as a wolf in sheep's clothing, but I think in this book he took the sheep's clothing off.
Who is Brian McLaren, and what has he done to make these people so angry? Well, McLaren is considered one of the country's most influential evangelicals, and his new book, A New Kind of Christianity, takes aim at some core doctrinal beliefs. McLaren is rethinking Jesus' mission on earth and even the purpose of the crucifixion.
The view of the cross that I was given growing up, in a sense, has a God who needs blood in order to be appeased. If this God doesn't see blood, God can't forgive.
McLaren believes that version of God is a misreading of the Bible.
God revealed in Christ crucified shows us a vision of God that identifies with the victim rather than the perpetrator, identifies with the one suffering rather than the one inflicting suffering.
McLaren says modern evangelicalism underplays that Jesus, who spent most of his time with the poor, the sick, and the sinners, and saved his wrath primarily for hardcore religious leaders. That's like a shot to the heart of Christian beliefs, says Al Mohler, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary.
Did Jesus go to the cross as a mere victim? If so, we have no gospel. We have no hope of everlasting life. Did Jesus go merely as a political prisoner executed because he had offended the regime? Well, if so, then that's a very interesting chapter in human history, but I'm not going to stake my life on it, much less my hope for eternity.
Mohler says McLaren and others like him are trying to rewrite the Christian story. And what alarms him is that young believers are attracted to this message. That's absolutely right, says Brian McLaren. Take the core evangelical belief that only Christians are going to heaven and everyone else is doomed.
A young evangelical, Roman Catholic, mainline Protestant growing up in America today, if he goes to college, his roommate might be Hindu, his roommate might be Muslim, his roommate might be Buddhist or atheist. So suddenly the other is sleeping across the room.
Brian McLaren is on to something here, says David Campbell, a professor at Notre Dame and co-author of American Grace, The Changing Role of Religion in America. His surveys show that nearly two-thirds of evangelicals under 35 believe that non-Christians can go to heaven, but only 39% of those over 65 believe that. That's because young evangelicals have grown up in a religiously plural society, Campbell says.
And it's really hard to condemn someone to eternal damnation on the basis of their religion when you know them well and have come to love them.
Surveys by Campbell and others show that young evangelicals differ from their elders in a lot of ways. They are less likely to read the Bible or take it literally. They pray and go to church less often. And they're more open to, say, evolution and gay rights. Al Mohler says he's saddened by all of this, but he's not surprised that young people buy Brian McLaren's version of Christianity.
I'm sure he's tapping into an exhaustion, a fatigue, a sense of wanting to be culturally relevant, a sense of not wanting to stand out from one's peers and neighbors. I certainly understand that. I just believe that the cost of following that route is literally the abandonment of historic biblical Christianity.
Mohler is determined to nip any such trend in the bud. But if Brian McLaren and surveys of young people are any guide, there seems to be an appetite for a different sort of evangelical Christianity. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.